Les colloques du Collège de France.
Thank you very much, Stephanie. And I want to start by thanking again Professor Besson for this very kind invitation and for organizing this fascinating event. I've been learning a lot already from yesterday. I have a caveat. I am neither a legal scholar nor a political philosopher. I'm just a philosopher of science. So I fear like what I'm going to be saying is going to sound like the cricket in Pinocchio's story here. Instead of abandoning philosophical ideas, I'm going to hold on to those. That's what I do. Yes, hopefully I'm going to be covering a lot of stuff that's already been said and explained in abundant legal details yesterday and also just now with Professor Tronchetti, but provide a slightly different lens to it. And I'm going to start by going back to some news headlines. So on the 30th of December 2024, a half-ton burnt metallic ring measuring 2.5-meter diameter fell from the sky in the Mukoko village in Kenya. And the Kenya Space Agency investigating the incident concluded that it was a separation ring from a launch rocket, although it proved impossible to establish the exact origin and the propriety of the object. And in January 2025, Qantas airline flights from Sydney to Johannesburg were delayed and disrupted due to possible falling debris from re-entering a space of a rocket. So these two episodes are really just the tip of an iceberg. They are symptomatic of a dire situation concerning alarming levels of space junk in the so-called low Earth orbit that we have heard already yesterday about. This is a region in outer space that covers roughly 1,000 kilometers above the mesosphere. And scientists estimate that currently there are 128 million small junk items, and by small they mean 1 centimeters wide, and 37,000 large items, about above 10 centimeter junk items in LEO, including debris from collision, dust from rocket booster, paint flecks, ice from nuclear reactor cooler, among others. So against this increasing level of spacefaring and space exploration, the challenges we face today are very different from those surrounding the introduction of the Outer Space Treaty in 1967 and the Moon Agreement in 1979. In between the aftermath of the Russian launch of Sputnik in 1957 and the eve of the lunar landing by the US mission led by Armstrong in July 1968, the Outer Space Treaty Article 2 mandated, as we know by now very well, that the outer space, including the moon and other celestial bodies, is not subject to national appropriation by claims of sovereignty by means of use or occupation. Fast forward half century, and in a very different geopolitical context, we're all facing different kinds of threats coming from lunar grabbing and outer space grabbing more in general. In a rampant free market, where not just state parties, but also private companies may apply and get approval to put in orbit satellites for scientific and commercial exploration, the outer space really risks becoming a graveyard of space junk orbiting around everyone's head. And the main problem with space junk concerns really its so far not yet well understood impact on the environment in the midst of an ongoing climate crisis. So this is just some news headlines of recent work that has been done in this direction. Scientists have been estimating that about 10% of aerosol particles present in the stratospheres are contaminated by heavy metals, including iron, aluminium, niobium, that originates from the vaporization of rockets' materials during spacecraft reentries. And such metallic contaminations have been detected in aerosol particles as low as 19 kilometers above the troposphere. While the full implications of these metal contaminations are still under study, one possible alarming side effect that we heard already yesterday being mentioned concerns ozone depletion from aluminium oxide, with potentially devastating consequences for the ongoing climate crisis. And really, this brings me to my topic today, which is to ask the question, what is at stake in Article 1 of the Outer Space Treaty that says that the exploration and use of outer space shall be the province of all mankind? Or in an even clearer language, in the Moon Agreement, Article 11.1, that speaks of the Moon and its natural resources as the common heritage of mankind. So what I hope to do is just to unpack some of the philosophical principle behind this important principle and also trying to understand a little bit better what's behind what, as we just heard from Professor Tronchetti, is a principle that has a very long and complex and controversial history in the legal regime. So roughly, this is the structure of my talk. In section two, I will briefly, very briefly recount some of the milestones in the legal history of the principle. I won't dwell too much. I mean, there are people that know about the history much better than me, as we just heard as well this morning. In section three, I want to draw some lessons from the history of the recent inclusion of the Common Heritage Principle in the BBNJ Agreement, which incidentally is how I got interested in the principle. I'm a philosopher that have been working over the past few years on questions about equitable ocean governance in a project with marine scientists and intellectual property rights lawyers. So this is my first foray into the law of outer space, but I've been working mostly on the Common Heritage Principle within the context of the BBNJ. So I want to just clarify some possible readings of the principle, explain how some of those should be resisted, and then in the final section four, I want to sketch the contour of a human rights approach to understanding the concept behind this principle. So overall, this is going to be my take-home message, if you like, my philosophical lesson. I want to be arguing that the Moon and outer space are best thought of as communal goods, whose common enjoyment also for future generations is justified by the continuity really between science and culture and the fact that current space exploration, we should never forget this, is just one small, tiny chronological fragment of a much broader, long tapestry of millennia-long cultural engagement with the Moon and outer space by myriads of communities, historically, culturally situated communities worldwide. So this is the overall picture. I'm going to start by going back very briefly to the history of the principle. And I'm surprised, actually, Pardo hasn't come up, if I remember correctly, yesterday in discussion, or maybe someone mentioned it. So I want to go back to the UN Malta ambassador, Arvin Pardo, on 17 August 1967, proposed effectively the Common Heritage Principle within the context of the UN law on the Convention of the Sea. And in a journal article published a year later in the context of geopolitical tensions in the Pacific, Pardo warned against the risk of, quote, a race to grab and hold the lands under the high seas. We must ensure that the deep seas and the ocean bottoms are and remain the legacy of all human beings, end of quote. The principle was eventually adopted as Article 136 in Part 11 of the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, which states, as we know by now very well, that the, quote, the area and its resources are common heritage of mankind, where the area denotes the ocean floor in area beyond national jurisdiction, and resources denote solid, liquid, or gaseous resources, quote, in situ in the area, at or beneath the seabed, including polymetallic nodules. Now, the importance of this legal provision in regulating deep sea mining cannot be stressed enough. The scramble for polymetallic nodule, rich in cobalt, manganese, and lithium, has dramatically accelerated over the past few decades as technology and societies increasingly revolve on lithium batteries for phones, tablets, computers, electric cars, just to mention a few examples. And the more recent BBNJ agreement, which was agreed in March 2023, reiterates the importance of the Common Heritage Principle under Article 7b. Most significantly, the BBNJ agreement extends the applicability from minerals to marine genetic resources, which are microorganisms, small invertebrate, mollusk, living entities forming ecosystem in hydrothermal vents, those are spring of hot water in the area due to platonic activity. And there's a lot of scientific interest in extracting those genetic resources, producing digital sequence information, and bioprospecting the potential uses of those resources for a medical and pharmaceutical reason. So despite its center stage role in the UN negotiation concerning ocean biodiversity, as we actually heard yesterday from Isabel, the Common Heritage Principle originated, in fact, from within discussion around the Outer Space Treaty, and it was really the UN Argentinian representative, Aldo Armando Coca, who reportedly first used the expression Common Heritage on 19 June 1967 within the UN Committee on Outer Space. Coca was the first to use the expression in 1970 draft on the Moon Agreement, whose Article 1 reads, quote, "The natural resources of the Moon and other celestial bodies shall be the common heritage of all mankind." And it's fair to say that half a century after the Common Heritage Principle was first introduced in the context of the UN Outer Space Committee and then adopted under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, Part 11, and now in the more recent BBNJ Agreement, discussions about the nature of the principles have really not fizzled out. So what's exactly at stake in this principle? What does it matter? And why I think it's an interesting topic also for philosophers like myself. There are a few distinctive features behind the principle, and we have heard already several of them coming up in various talks yesterday and also this morning. So the first one is that the common heritage bans sovereign claims by state parties on the moon and its resources, or on the mineral in the ocean floor, or on marine genetic resources. It does not ban appropriation in the form of exploitation or mining. That is possible, that's what's happening. Second, by claiming that these spaces, their resources and exploitation belong to humankind, the principle effectively invites to a common sharing of those resources. How we should understand this common sharing remains obviously open for discussion. It's something that I will focus in the rest of this talk. And third, the word heritage suggests that this common sharing is not limited to the current generation, but it's something that extends to future generation that will inherit these spaces, resources, and their exploration and exploitation. So there is an implicit element of intergenerational justice in how equitably these spaces and resources ought to be shared in common, as opposed to how they are currently shared. So going back to the normative dimension that Professor Stiltz was mentioning yesterday. And then there's a fourth aspect. Because of this implicit element of intergenerational justice, the common sharing of spaces and resources can only be for peaceful purposes and for scientific exploration. So it cannot be for war or reciprocally destructive or damaging purposes, although obviously it can be used for military purposes, as indeed is already happening. Understanding the philosophical foundation of this principle and unpacking the distinctive features, I mean, have become all the more salient. These are just some of the news headlines in recent years, really, of this race to explore and exploit outer space by various nation states. And obviously, whether it is to extract, we heard yesterday from Professor Morbidelli, precious helium-3 isotopes from regolith on the lunar crust for use as a non-radioactive nuclear fusion, or whether it is to extract ice that could be used for longer-term sustenance by astronauts. Lunar mining, asteroid mining is with us and it's only about to start. So the US Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, DARPA, launched in 2023 a 10-year program to develop lunar economy, and with a plan to have, by 2035, a range of infrastructure in place for commercial use. And NASA just recently announced fast-tracking plans to build a nuclear reactor on the moon directly. So in the next two sections, I want to do what philosophers typically do, so please bear with me, explain three possible ways of understanding the key feature of sharing in common that, as I said, is one of the defining features of the Common Heritage Principle. And I will suggest very briefly, as I don't have the time, to resist a couple of those readings, and I will be advocating making a plea for a third one. So I'm going to be drawing on this paper that is already out, and as I said, in that paper I was really looking at the Common Heritage Principle in the context of the marine genetic resources and the BBNJ agreement. And in that paper, I consider three possible readings of the Common Heritage Principles in terms of public goods, global commons, or communal goods. And I analyze some of the problems inherent in the first two readings before advocating for the third one. And so what I want to do is just to very briefly extend this analysis to the moon and outer space. So according to the first reading, a possible way of reading what it means to share in common, encapsulated by the Common Heritage Principle, would be along the lines of Roman law, which really back to the Justinian Digesta, saw the sea and the shores as res communis humanitatis. So on this reading, everyone can reclaim from themselves the right to use, explore, and exploit the sea and the seashores. And the Justinian text mentions also the air in addition to flowing water, sea and the shores. So it might be tempting to read the Common Heritage in the Moon Treaty along these lines as res communis, and this is, I think, how some scholars effectively read it, or probably most of the legal scholars read it. So on this reading, the moon and outer space would be there for anyone really to explore and exploit. And given the more recent development in the geopolitical context and the lunar race escalating, it seems hard to escape the inevitability of this first interpretation. The moon is there to be grabbed and to be used, together with the asteroids, on a first-come, first-served basis. Now, there is, a glaring problem with this reading of the Common Heritage Principle. No matter whether it applies to the ocean floor, to the moon, or the marine genetic resources, it treats public good in a kind of self-defeating way. So public goods are goods that are, in the economy sense, non-excludable and non-rival. So as I pointed out in this article of 2024, non-exclusivity of common resources does not imply non-excludability. The technological ability of a state to explore and exploit the moon and asteroids resources in a non-exclusive way might well end up excluding others from exercising the same public use right to explore and exploit. Moreover, the non-exclusivity in public use right of a common resource does not necessarily imply that their use is not rival. If left rampant and unchecked, such unbridled use might well decrease the value of the good for others to enjoy, given the irreparable damage done by mining. So if the common heritage is understood as res communis, it seems to me that the commonness of the moon and the resources, and by extension of outer space, defeats the very two defining criteria for public good, there being non-excludable and non-rival. Switching to the second reading, can maybe the common heritage be understood in terms of global commons? Again, this is something that came up yesterday in some of the talks. This is a very different notion of common sharing because it doesn't just assume that everyone can use the space and resources in a way that is non-excludable and non-rival. It also assumes that such spaces and resources and their enjoyment in common are accompanied by a management in common. So really we're going back to British medieval law where forest and seashore were managed in common by local people, the commoners. So under this reading, it might seem that the way forward for the implementation of the Moon Agreement, assuming that enough states have even ratified it, which obviously doesn't seem to be happening anytime soon, would be to create something equivalent to the role of the International Seabed Authority. And I think, again, this came up yesterday. I think it was brought up in the afternoon session. So to create an institution that can regulate, monitor, and grant licenses in the common management of those shared resources. So what is there to be said about this second possible reading of the common heritage in terms of global commons? I think here the analogy with the medieval British legal notion of commons might seem a bit jarring in this particular context. One might argue that by contrast with seafaring, when it comes to spacefaring, scientific and technological powers are really all that matter, and only a handful of states can legitimately reclaim the title of space powers. Unsurprisingly, those are the same states that haven't signed up to the Moon Agreement. And then there's a third reading, which is the one I will be kind of defending. And apologies, as I said, I'm going pretty quickly just in the interest of time on all this. A third possible way of reading the common heritage principle is in terms of communal good. Here, really, I want to mention Professor Besson's work in this area, but also the work of Jeremy Waldron and other legal scholars that have emphasized how some goods can only be communal in the sense that their enjoyment and communal sharing implies that there has to be a mutual and reciprocal way in which everyone relates to the exploitations of those goods. So a classical example, friendship. I cannot claim to be a friend of Mary unless Mary can also legitimately claim to be my friend, or I cannot claim that my party is convivial unless everyone is having a wonderful time at the party. If someone is having a miserable time, then we can't say that the party is convivial. What I want to discuss, I'm not going to really making any argument for this. I'm just going to take that as my starting point because I'm interested in exploring in what remains of my time, what kind of human rights may attach to the moon and outer space if we understand them as communal goods, and relatedly, what kind of duties and obligation for states may follow. So I'm interested in the question of can a human rights approach to the common heritage principle provide this principle and its complex and politically vexed and controversial history with the prescriptive force that the principle has historically lacked. With space exploration at an all-time high, space science has grown remarkably. And as with any other scientific discipline, space science too falls within the scope and the remit of the human right to science, which is recognized as Article 27.1 in the 1948 UN Declaration of Human Rights, and again Article 15b in the 1966 International Covenant for Economic, Social, Cultural Rights. The right to science encapsulates more than just the right to freedom to do science, freedom to scientific opinion, freedom to scientific assembly, or indeed the right to receive a scientific education, the right to pursue a career in science. It is also a right to access scientific information, and importantly, it's a right to participate in science. And when it comes to this participatory aspect of science, Samantha Besson has argued for the need to treat science as a communal good. And the UN Special Rapporteur on Cultural Rights, both in 2012 with Farida Shaheed and in 2024, have really further stressed this participatory aspect of the human right. So I just want to very briefly mention the latest report by Alexandra Xantaki on the right to participate in science that really highlight how science is continuous with culture, and indeed the right to participate in science is included in the right to participate in the cultural life of the communities. And the report stresses the importance of scientific diversities, and with reference to my work in philosophy, the report stresses that, quote, scientific knowledge is produced by communities that are historically and culturally situated. So taking this legal scholarship as a springboard, I really want to make two moves. Actually, probably I'm going to make just one if we have only 5 minutes left, so I'm afraid you'll have to bear with one, and the other one can be left to the paper. And really, the first one is that spacefaring and space exploration is not a private affair for the economic interests of only a few space power or private corporation. Everyone has the right to participate in science, where obviously the modality of this participation will inevitably differ. I'm not suggesting everyone should take a spaceship and go to the moon. But in the same of the right to participate in science, one might argue that there is a legitimate ground for advancing participatory claims against unbridled and unchecked space exploration, which risk treating out the space as a res nullius. And my second move, which probably I won't have time to make, so I'm just going to state it, is that where there are rights, obviously there are obligations to respect, protect, and fulfill those rights. So in the case of the moon and outer space, I would be interested in making a human rights-based argument to articulate those duties and obligations on behalf of nation states and private corporations. And such arguments rely on the link between the right to participate in science and the right to a healthy and clean environment. So I'm just going to very briefly mention the first one, maybe. What reason do we have for thinking that the moon and outer space are communal goods, are somehow akin to friendship and conviviality? And my argument really relies on this all-important link between the right to science and the right to participate in the cultural life of the communities. There is a substantive way of understanding the participatory claim behind the right to science in relation to the moon and outer space, because those objects have been central to the cultural life of countless past and present and future culturally situated communities across the globe. So back in Mesopotamia, cuneiform tables dating as back as 1820 in the Sumer town of Ur and Nippur have been found celebrating in him the beneficial god Moon called Nanna for embellishing the night and for the fertility of animal herds. In the Maya culture in Mexico, between 900 and 1542, the moon was regarded as the lady of the earth. It was associated with the ritual festivity, and the Mayan calendar itself relies on moon cycle. In Imperial Japan, the moon and lunar calendar regulated agricultural artisanal practices, including weaving, and the fest of Tanabata on the seventh day of the seventh lunar month celebrate to this day the boatman of the moon carrying the weaving princess star, the star Vega, to our beloved cowherd, the star Altair, through the Milky Way. And among the Wahungwe Makoni people of Zimbabwe, there's a cosmogony and creation myth that starts with the moon as the first man whose love for his first wife, Masasi, gave rise to all animal species and to the grand chief of the Wahungwe people. And in Polynesian culture, the moon is called Ina and is given for importance in voyages across the ocean, is associated with the Ina, water of life. So I'm telling you all this just to stress and emphasize once again, as you would expect from someone that does history of science and philosophy of science, that space science and space exploration are just a tiny chronological fragment of a much broader tapestry of cultural engagement with the moon in outer space that different people in different geocultural contexts have developed for millennia. And for some of those people and their culture, the moon is sacred and is the seat of their ancestor and the origins of their historical lineage. So preserving this cultural tradition and cultural heritage is key to preserving the very identities of those communities. And so once seen from this viewpoint, the current space race can be put in its historical context, and one is really reminded here of the word of the Ambassador Pardo in reference to the common heritage principle. One might say that if you take a piece of the lunar surface, you take it from humankind. If you appropriate its mineral, you're stealing them from humankind. And if you damage its surface, you're damaging something that equally belongs to the Sumerian, the Mayan, the Japanese, the Polynesian, alike, past, present, and future. And I think, just to sum up, I think this is what makes the moon and outer space really common heritage of humankind, in analogy with cultural heritage, the boundless tapestry of cosmogony, creation stories, artistic representation, musical and literary expressions, the over millennia stretching across different cultures have entangled us with the moon and outer space. I'm going to stop there. I'm going to leave you. There was a second part of the paper, which I'm not going to go into. Yes, piece of good news that I think has already been mentioned yesterday. The BBNJ agreement passed the 60th signatory last Friday with Morocco, so it will come into effect as of January 2026, which will be interesting to see what's going to happen, because at this point it's a principle in the BBNJ. And yeah, this is some of the work that I've been doing with colleagues for this project about the ocean in Edinburgh. We have a book coming out called Where's the World Knowing in January next year. Thank you so much, and apologies.
Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.